Saving money on your entire roofing project now at Menards. Protect your home for years to come with Owens Corning Architectural Shingles. They offer long-lasting performance while providing ultimate protection with a 130 miles per hour wind rating and limited lifetime warranty. Choose from over 50 options of Owens Corning shingles in-store and on Menards.com. And check out more of our great deals going on now. Save big money at Menards.
Hi, everyone. This is Jillian with Court Junkie. Court Junkie is a true crime podcast that covers court cases and criminal trials using audio clips and interviews with people close to the cases. Court Junkie is available on Apple Podcasts and PodcastOne.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 239 of the True Crime All the Time Unsolved podcast. I'm Mike Ferguson, and with me, as always, is my partner in true crime, Mike Gibson. Gibby, what's going on with you, man?
Man, I'm doing good. How about you?
Doing great.
Good.
Got a full belly. Got a couple of episodes already under our belt.
Under our belt? Yes.
Along with the full belly. We just recorded a Patreon episode that would have dropped Saturday night on William Inman, a young serial killer out of Arizona, who was caught in a very unusual way.
Very unusual way.
Yeah, it's definitely worth a listen. And we have an episode out right now on True Crime All the Time on Jesus Mesquia, who murdered singer Mia Zapata, the lead singer of the Gits. She was on her way up, Gibbs. They were about ready to hit the big time.
They were.
And then she ran into this predator, but it took a long time to solve the murder, and there's DNA involved and all of that. It's a good story, though.
It's a really good story.
We have some shout outs. Let's start with Patreon. We had Omri Ashkenazi.
What's up, What's up, Ashkenazi?
I don't think that came out right, but we'll go with it.
Gotta love it.
Willa Miller.
Hey, Willa.
Enrique Anguiano.
Hey, Anguiano.
Lauren Padilla.
Hey, Padilla.
Madeline Akers.
Hey, Madeline.
Cozy Jow.
Gotta be cozy, man.
Gotta be.
It's important.
Jason McKee.
Hey, Jason.
Man Who Sold the World.
Well, I hope you got a lot of money for it.
Louis Sparr.
Hey, Louis.
Chantal Herbert.
Or her burr. Or her bay.
A bear.
A bear.
Oh, you are on fire tonight. Antonio Torrey.
What's going on, Antonio?
Leslie Kales.
Hey, Leslie.
Elizabeth Ann.
Hey, Elizabeth.
Noel Crupo.
What's going on, Crupo?
Kedra Aldridge.
Hey, Aldridge.
Mary Morrison.
Hey, appreciate that, MM.
And last but not least, Ozzy Killick.
What was going on, Ozzy? How's that train going?
And then if we go back into the vault, Gibbs. This week, we selected Emily Flaws.
Hey, Emily.
So appreciate the new support, the long-term support. We had some great PayPal donations from Stephen Kessler.
Hey, Stephen.
Christy Delasorda.
What's going on, Delasorda?
And Robert Pearson.
Hey, Robert.
So thanks to all of you as well. All right, buddy. Are you ready to get into this episode of True Crime All the Time Unsolved?
Man, I am ready.
We are talking about the Villisca axe murders. This is a case that, you know, happened back in the early 1900s, but it's a case that fascinates people to this day. There are a lot of armchair detectives, amateur sleuths. This gets a lot of play.
It does.
In some of the true crime forums and things like that. I think that just because of the facts and the mystery and everything that surrounds the case.
It's been one that people always message us about.
They have for years and years and years, and we're finally doing it.
Finally getting there.
On a summer evening in June 1912, the Moore family and two house guests retired to bed for the evening at their home in the town of Villisca in Montgomery County in southwestern Iowa. At some point in the early hours of the following morning, all eight occupants of the home were viciously bludgeoned to death with an axe. What made this case even more tragic was that six of the eight victims were children. The victims were Josiah Moore, his wife Sarah, and their four children, Herman, Mary Catherine, Arthur, and Paul. Two of Mary Catherine's friends, Lena and Ina Stillinger, who were daughters of family friends of the Moores, were also murdered. Lena and Ina were sisters and had been staying at the Moore home on that fateful night. The bodies were found the following day by Josiah's brother, who made the sickening discovery. So no doubt, Gibbs, the brutal and gruesome nature of this crime rocked the small town. Residents lived in fear that they could be next. And law enforcement knew the pressure was on to apprehend whoever was responsible. So, you know, we're going all the way back to 1912, but that's something that doesn't change over the years, right? When you have a gruesome murder that rocks a small town, the same thing still happens today. It causes fear in the community. We've talked about it. Gun sales go up nowadays, security system sales, things like that, dogs. And the other thing that remains today is the pressure on law enforcement put on by the community to, you know, figure out who did this and to get them off the street. Nobody wants to be next.
Nope.
And nobody wants to have a person capable of doing what this person did just walking around with the rest of us. We've already mentioned it. Most of the victims were children. So whoever the attacker was, they had no qualms about savagely murdering anyone, regardless of age, sex. They didn't care.
So basically, you had a killer out there willing to wipe out a whole entire family without a thought. Well, I don't know about you, but if it was me and I lived in that neighborhood or anywhere near that vicinity, I don't know if I'd be able to sleep through the night.
Not for a while. It'd be tough. You know, you and I have talked about sitting in a chair, standing guard. You got a vicious killer out there. You got to protect your family. Not once, but twice did local police think that they had their killer. But we've seen time and time again, Gibbs, police think that they know who did it. They think they have them in custody. But what really matters is the outcome of a trial, the jury system. When someone walks away, as they did in this case, the answers can seem even further away than they did at the start of the investigation. And we mentioned it, right? To this very day, armchair detectives everywhere continue to debate the identity of the mystery killer.
Yes, one of the most popular unsolved cases out there.
So let's dive into this case. On the evening of June 9th, 1912, 43-year-old Josiah, 39-year-old Sarah, 11-year-old Herman, 10-year-old Mary Catherine, 7-year-old Arthur, and 5-year-old Paul were on their way home after attending a children's program at their local Presbyterian church.
Those are some really young kids.
They are. And it's heartbreaking based on what we know happens. Joining the family was 11-year-old Lena Stillinger and her 8-year-old sister, Ina, who Mary Catherine had invited for a sleepover. Church ended around 9:30 p.m., and the group walked the 3 blocks back to the Moore family home, arriving around 15 to 20 minutes later. Lena and Ina were staying in a guest bedroom downstairs, situated off the parlor. And the Moores were relatively well off.
Yeah, and they had a pretty good reputation in the community, too.
Yeah, Josiah had a thriving business. They were also active in their local church, where Sarah played a pivotal role in coordinating the annual Children's Day services. They had been living at the two-story Queen Anne-style home on East 2nd Street since 1903. Josiah, or Joe, as he was known to most people, was one of 14 children. He married his wife, Sarah, in 1899. and he ran a successful business in town selling farm equipment. According to the Villisca Review newspaper, Lena and Ina Stillinger were daughters of a wealthy farming family who lived just outside of town. Now, there's a couple of different accounts floating around about how the killer entered the home. According to iowacoldcases.org, the murderer found Josiah's axe in the backyard and entered the house around midnight. Another report states the killer snuck into the home through an unlocked window while the family was out at church. He hid in the attic where he smoked cigarettes while he waited until the Moores and their guests went to bed. Either way, it occurred. When everyone in the household was asleep, the killer struck sometime between midnight and 5 a.m. Lighting an oil lamp and taking Josiah's axe, he went upstairs to the main bedroom. He placed the lamp on the floor and proceeded to kill Josiah using the blade of the axe. And then he turned his sights on Sarah. The intruder then moved to the children's nearby bedroom where he executed Herman, Mary Catherine, Arthur, and Paul with the blunt end of the axe before he headed downstairs to the guest bedroom to kill Lena and Ina Stillinger. The coroner theorized that by this time, Lena may have actually been awake. So when you think about that, Gibbs, that's tough to imagine.
Well, you would think somebody had to be awake by that point. You know, when you have all that ruckus going on, right?
There would have been some noise.
Some screaming, you would think, at that point. So then what would it feel like hearing somebody come down the steps and knowing that whatever happened upstairs might be happening to you soon?
Well, not only that, but whatever is about to happen, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
I mean, these girls were young. Not only how am I going to protect myself, but how am I going to protect my sister? But Lena did try to fight off the Axeman because she sustained a defensive wound to her arm before she was hacked to death. But the murderer wasn't finished. He returned to the main bedroom where he attacked Josiah and Sarah for a second time. It was said, Gibbs, that he rained down somewhere between 20 to 30 blows on Josiah, removing his eyes in the process.
Some brutality there.
Yeah, well, I mean, we said up front, right? Brutal, vicious. I don't even know if those words are descriptive enough. I don't even know if they capture exactly how bad this was. The murderer covered his victims' faces with their bloody bedsheets. He then drew the curtains over the windows in the house, and he ransacked the family's dresser drawers using aprons and skirts to cover all the mirrors and windows, which didn't have curtains.
It's a bizarre thing to do, right?
Well, to cover the mirrors is bizarre to me. I get covering the windows that don't have curtains. You don't want anyone to see you, right, to see what you're doing. But what does it say when you cover a mirror?
Yeah. You don't want to see yourself.
And why not? You know, to me, that means you don't like yourself. You don't like what you just did. Right. You're ashamed, something along those lines. Now, I'm speculating, but I think it's a pretty good speculation.
I think so, too.
The killer left the axe inside the room where Lena and Ina were staying. He washed up in a basin, which he left on the kitchen bench filled with bloody water. Then he slipped out the door, locking it behind him.
Well, he's a thoughtful killer.
Well, you don't want anyone getting in to steal whatever's left in the house.
But I can see why he did what he did. Lock the door, cover the windows, not only so people can't see what you're doing at that time, but when the morning comes, if anybody stops by, they can't come in the house, they can't look through the windows. They just assume everybody's either gone for the day or whatever. You don't know because you can't see in. It buys him more time.
Yeah, at the very least, I think that's what he's trying to do, right? He's trying to delay the discovery of this massacre. The next morning around 7 a.m., one of the Moore's neighbors noticed that the family hadn't gotten up. Their chickens were still shut up from the night before. This was very unlike the Moores. They got up early, like most other people in the town did, to get a head start on the day's chores. Gives us just what you had to do back then.
Sure. You didn't have time to take it easy.
No, I don't think there was a whole lot of taking it easy. There were a lot of chores. There were a lot of things to be done. The neighbor grew so concerned that she knocked on the door. There was no answer. And when she tried to open it, she found that it was locked. So the neighbor contacted Josiah's brother, Ross, who showed up at the house around 8 a.m., but he had no luck making contact with any of the family inside. I think what everyone was afraid of was that the Moores had fallen ill and maybe were unable to call for help. But as they were about to find out, Gibbs, obviously it was a whole lot worse. Ross managed to gain access with a spare key, and the neighbor waited outside while he went in to take a look around. The house was dark inside, and when Ross entered the parlor, nothing seemed out of the ordinary. But as he opened the door to the adjoining downstairs bedroom, he was confronted with the stomach-churning sight of what appeared to be two bodies covered with a blood-stained bedsheet. An axe, which had been partially wiped clean, was also in the room. Bizarrely, a 2-pound slab of bacon wrapped in some cloth was placed next to the axe, and a piece of a keychain lay on the floor. The local marshal was contacted, showed up fairly quickly. Going room to room, he discovered the entire family was dead. They had seemingly been killed with Josiah's axe and had all been covered with bed sheets after they were killed. In the downstairs bedroom lay the bodies of Lena and Ina Stillinger. According to the Villisca Review, the sisters were so badly bludgeoned that their identities couldn't be initially confirmed. Lena's lower body and genitals were exposed. Her nightgown was bunched up around her waist. And unlike the other victims, she was laid out across the bed, indicating that she had not been asleep when the killer struck.
And we kind of talked about that, thinking that she heard the killer coming.
Well, based on the defensive wounds, right? That kind of speaks to the fact that she was awake. She tried to protect herself. An oil lamp had been placed at the foot of the bed without the protective glass chimney over the flame. According to VilliscaIowa.com, among the carnage in the main bedroom upstairs was one of Sarah's shoes, which had been filled with the dripping blood from Josiah.
That makes my stomach churn a little bit, you know, thinking about how much blood had to drip to fill a shoe.
And I guess at one point, the shoe had been knocked over, spilling all of that blood onto the floor. As in the downstairs bedroom, an oil lamp had been left at the foot of Josiah and Sarah's bed with the glass chimney removed. So to me, Gibbs, that fact is strange, that in both of these rooms, they found lamps with the protective glass shields, whatever you want to call them, removed.
Yeah, it's like someone took it off, lit it, and didn't put it back on. Why?
We don't know. But you wouldn't think that the family would have gone to sleep with the lamps in that condition.
No.
No way.
No. Too dangerous.
According to the Sioux City Journal, the killings had been so frenzied that the ceilings in the upstairs bedrooms had been damaged by the axe. I mean, think about that. Visualize this person raining down blows with the axe to the point where on the upswing, they're striking the bedroom ceiling.
And doing damage to it.
Over and over and over. There were said to be remains of recently smoked cigarettes found in the attic and a plate of uneaten food on the kitchen table. So I think the recently smoked cigarettes in the attic, that's where you get into this theory that the attacker possibly had broken in.
Hung out in the attic.
Hung out in the attic and waited for everyone to go to sleep. So obviously, Gibbs, these murders shocked the town. But not just that. They shocked the entire state of Iowa and even the entire country.
I can only imagine, you know, I mean, murder with an axe, and you got six young kids plus the, you know, the mom and dad. It's got to be devastating.
Yeah, it made national headlines. Officers arranged for tracking dogs to trace the scent of the killer on the outskirts of town. But according to the Evening Standard newspaper, the trail was lost at the Nottoway River, which ran close to Villisca. Fingerprinting as an investigative tool was fairly new at the time, but no prints were found, nor were any footprints found at the scene. So far, we don't have a lot to go on.
We do not.
Police didn't have much to go on, but they wanted to find out if there was anyone who wished the Moore family any harm. And that makes a lot of sense to me, right? Eight people murdered, an entire family plus two individuals who were staying the night. Mm-hmm. The police's first thought had to be, all right, somebody had a real problem with this family.
Yeah.
Let's find out who it was. Because if it wasn't that, then you're looking into scenarios involving, you know, someone maybe just passing through, or could it have been a local who had no connection to the family, but felt like killing an entire family? I mean, obviously there are a number of scenarios here. It could have been someone local with a hatred of the family. It could have been someone who traveled into town for the express purpose of killing the family, but then also killed the Stillinger sisters to avoid being identified. I think as far as police were concerned, every person in Villisca at the time, local or not, was a potential suspect.
Had to be.
You know, folks, some days can be a real struggle. The good news is I'm having a lot less of those since I found True Niagen. I love it. True Niagen helps fuel the cell's energy engine, maintain cellular metabolism, and even supports heart health in combination with a healthy lifestyle. With 13 published human clinical studies and backed by Nobel Prize winners, True Niagen is a supplement that's clinically proven to boost NAD levels, an essential coenzyme required for cellular energy and repair. Since taking True Niagen, I have more resiliency and it helps my muscles recover. I just have more zest for life. Add more vitality to your life today with True Niagen. Right now, new customers can save 10% on their first purchase by going to TrueNiagen.com/unsolved and use code unsolved. That's TrueNiagen.com/unsolved, code unsolved, to save 10% on your first purchase. TrueNiagen.com/unsolved, code unsolved. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. And next up, let's talk about Native. Native cares about the products you put on your body. Now, they want to make sure that you smell good, but they want you to do it the right way. That's the Native difference. You've heard me talk about Native's legendary aluminum-free deodorant. Their mission is to overhaul your entire hygiene routine. And they do that by creating products that are made with simple ingredients. Now, they have their classics, but they also have rotating seasonal scents, so Native has a scent for everyone. Try their holiday-scented deodorant, body wash, or toothpaste. These come in scents like candy cane, sugar cookie, and fresh mistletoe. These are only for a limited time. The sugar cookie is really good. That one is my favorite. Giving the gift of self-care is easy with Native. You can build yourself or loved ones personalized product bundles by mixing and matching three of your favorite holiday-scented products into a set. So stay merry, happy, and fresh this holiday season. You will love Native's limited-time seasonal products as much as I do. Go to nativedeodorant.com and use code TCAT to get 20% off your first purchase at checkout. That's nativedeodorant.com, code TCAT, for 20% off. nativedeodorant.com, code TCAT. So it makes sense, Gibbs, that police would want to question anyone from out of town. The population of Villisca back then was around 2,500. So, you know, it's not huge. It wasn't a bustling city by any means, but it's still a lot of work.
Well, sure it is.
To, you know, question 2,500 people or however many adults lived in the town.
It was going to take some time.
And I think this was for a couple of different reasons. Number one, they had to question a lot of people. We talked about that. But also, residents flocked to the house as word spread around town in the hours after the bodies were discovered. So you can imagine a throng of people showing up at this house. The crime scene became contaminated because you had all these people who wanted to see the grisly sight for themselves. The police had a trouble, I think, keeping them out of the house.
Well, I think the curiosity of what happened at the house once the rumors got out, I think people wanted to go and see that. You know, you didn't have TV like you do today. So this would have been, I hate to say it, kind of like entertainment.
Well, in a way, it's almost like reality television.
Yeah.
People want to see things that they've never seen before. And I can imagine nobody in that town had ever seen anything like this.
Curiosity.
Law enforcement was initially unsure whether Lena had been sexually assaulted, given the fact that she wasn't wearing any underwear and that her nightgown had been pushed up. But doctors concluded that she hadn't been sexually assaulted. So it was known that the killer used Josiah's axe. And let's face it, Gibbs, in rural areas in the early 20th century, axes were common tools for families to have lying around the property. They were everyday implements for things like chopping firewood and killing poultry for food. I think today, most people don't think about killers hoping to find something inside the victim's home to be used as the murder weapon.
They're probably coming a little bit more prepared.
Yes.
Sadly.
Bringing something to be used as the murder weapon with them. I think the thought here is that this killer would have known that the chances of finding an axe on the property would have been extremely high. The day after the bodies were discovered, an inquest was held where key witnesses gave evidence, including the Moore's neighbor, local doctors, and Josiah's brothers. Now, Gibbs, I think most people would think an entire family being killed by an axe murderer would be pretty rare. But according to the Colorado Springs Herald, in 1911, a family in Colorado Springs was killed by an axe murderer. In October of that same year, a family in Illinois was slaughtered, along with two further slayings in Kansas. But the suspect or suspects in these murders were never identified. Several years passed before there were any real meaningful breakthroughs. According to reports, one witness sighting supported the police case against a man named William Mansfield, who was said to be a violent killer. The witness claimed that the morning after the murders, he spoke to a man matching Mansfield's description. He was catching a train in the nearby town of Clarinda. According to the website VeliscaIowa.com, the man claimed to have walked 15 miles from Villisca. 2 years after the murders, Mansfield's wife, infant, and parents-in-law were viciously killed with an axe in his hometown of Blue Island, Illinois. This was in July of 1914. In 1916, 4 years after the Villisca murders, a grand jury supported opening an investigation into Mansfield, and he was arrested. There was a strong suspicion he'd massacred not only his own family, but the Moores and Stillinger sisters as well. The problem was Mansfield had an alibi in the form of payroll records showing that he wasn't in Villisca at the time and he ended up being released.
Man, but think about if it wasn't him.
That's one hell of a coincidence.
Yeah. That his family was killed basically the same way as the Villisca murders.
Yeah. I mean, so you could see why people would think, okay, maybe this guy had something to do with it. Not to mention the fact that you had this witness who claimed that he saw a man matching this guy's description, catching a train, not too far from Villisca.
I mean, I get it. He's got some payroll records that give him an alibi, but I don't know. Is it that difficult to...
Well, how good were payroll records in the early 1900s. Yeah. You didn't have a time clock that you were punching or anything like that, I don't believe.
How good is payroll anywhere? I mean, remember that time I worked for you? You always thought I was at work working.
Right. And it came out that you had somebody punching in and out for you.
Absolutely.
So you just needed alibis all the time.
All the time.
Just in case.
That's right.
Something cropped up. But there was another person who kind of brought themselves to the attention of the police. Reverend George Kelly was one of numerous out-of-towners who had not only been in Villisca the night of the murders, but had been teaching at the same church service that the Moores attended that night. He'd made a pretty quick departure, too, catching a train out of town on June 10th between 5 and 5:30 a.m. And I think the timing is important because at that time, nobody but the killer would have known about the murders. But it's been said that Reverend Kelly was telling fellow passengers on the train the terrible news.
If that's true, how did he know?
Right. We just said nobody knew but the killer. And then I think the more the public learned about this Reverend Kelly, the more likely it seemed to people that he could be responsible. Just after the murders, he began writing to local law enforcement about the case, not once, but a number of times.
So he's trying to inject himself into the case?
Yeah. I mean, this is not uncommon, right? We've seen it in cases time after time. According to iowacoldcases.org, he returned to Villisca 2 weeks after the killings, pretending to be a detective. And he even managed to sneak into the property to join law enforcement as they analyzed the crime scene.
Well, that's a big problem, I think. Why is he doing that?
Well, there's really only two reasons that I can think of. Number one, he was the killer. And he wanted to maybe, you know, find out what law enforcement knew at that time, if they were on to anyone. Or number two, he was kind of a voyeur. If he wasn't the killer, then, you know, he wanted to be in that house. He wanted to see where it happened and kind of, you know, blend in with law enforcement. And, you know, there are people like that.
Yeah, the people, they want to be in the know.
Sure.
Kind of nebby, sort of.
Yeah, if you say so, I guess you. But either way, it doesn't make you look good, right? If the police find out that you're doing this, you're going to jump to the top of their suspect list. And Reverend Kelly's obsession with the case went far beyond anything anyone considered a healthy interest. He also took it upon himself to contact the Moore and Stillinger families.
Well, maybe he was trying to do the good reverend thing, you know, give them some peace and.
Yeah, trying to help them out during their time of grief. You could look at it that way. You could also say, well, maybe there was something else motivating him. I mean, no matter what, police found his level of interest in the case unusual. So they decided to see if he knew more than what he was letting on. According to the Villisca Review, the information he provided only piqued the investigators' interest into his involvement in the case. Apparently, Gibbs, he provided specific details that placed him very close to, if not directly at, the crime scene. Law enforcement dug into his background and they found information that provided further circumstantial evidence that he may have been involved. They found out that years before, as a teenager, the Reverend was reported to have suffered a mental health episode. Now, we don't know all the details of his illness beyond the fact that it was said that he was unwell during this period of time, but he was described by many as being an unusual person.
Well, I can see why.
What came out that he was known to have approached young women, asking them to pose nude, and he had also been caught peeping in windows. The behavior continued, and in early 1914, he was caught for mailing obscene material to a woman.
Obscene material. Makes you wonder.
You have to wonder what obscene material was in 1914. We know what it is today. It's everywhere.
Yes.
You can find it pretty easily.
That's right.
little tougher in 1914, I would think.
I would think so, too.
I don't think he was taking Polaroids of himself and...
Maybe there were sketches.
And mailing those off.
I'll sketch myself and send that to somebody.
According to the Sioux Falls Press, he was admitted to a psychiatric hospital in Washington, D.C. In July of 1914, he claimed that he was no longer unwell, but authorities disagreed with his assessment. All right, so let's go back and kind of analyze some of this. Approaching a young woman today and asking them to pose nude for you would be so far out of line.
Oh, of course.
It's not even funny.
Yeah.
But think back to 1914, to that time period. Asking a question like that back then, I mean, women didn't even show much skin in public, I don't believe, you know, during that period.
Right.
It's just so far out there. And apparently there have been peeping Toms as long as there have been windows. That's what I'm taking.
I believe that to be true. But it really gets worse for him.
Yeah, it gets a lot worse. According to the New York Times, Reverend Kelly was arrested in mid-1917 on suspicion of murder, and he was put in jail where he awaited trial. He was subjected to intense interrogation by law enforcement, which resulted in a signed statement confessing to killing the Moore family and the Stillinger sisters. Reverend Kelly claimed that the voice of God compelled him to, quote, slay utterly and commit the murders. But the newspaper also reported the Reverend's wife stated he'd told her the confessions were false. Now, there's no doubt, Gibbs, back then, far less was known about mental illness than is today. But the guy did confess.
He did.
But even so, police were unsure whether he was being truthful about the details he was providing or whether he was just fabricating some type of narrative due to his vulnerable mental state. I think the other issue that police had with Reverend Kelly was that he was short. He had a very slight build. They weren't sure if he was actually physically capable of committing the attacks on these eight people with an axe.
I think today you'd have to question that. I think you'd be surprised what people can do with adrenaline pumped through them. And I just don't know if because he has a smaller stature that he couldn't do that.
No, I don't think you can say he couldn't do it, but I could understand why they might question it. These were vicious attacks, repeated blows, you know, bringing that axe above your head, bringing it down over and over. Okay. Does it take a little bit of strength? Sure.
I don't know when the last time you decided to cut some firewood.
It's been a while.
But you probably remember how that goes. It's never fun.
No. But I will say, I have known some guys in my life who were what you would call wiry,
mm-hmm.
that were as strong as you could imagine.
Yeah.
So, you know, to that point, beefiness or, you know, how tall you are, it doesn't always absolutely equate to strength.
I agree.
I've known some small guys who were very, very strong, but he's going to trial. And at his first trial, the jury was split in their decision about whether Reverend Kelly was guilty. The prosecution's case wasn't helped by the fact that he recanted his confession during the trial, and it resulted in a hung jury. Reverend Kelly went to trial again just weeks later on the same charge, this time with a different jury. The court was shown the murder weapon at the second trial, and jurors heard how Lena's body might have been moved after she was butchered. The defense argued that Reverend Kelly was insane at the time. The jury didn't consider Reverend Kelly's confession to be sufficient evidence that he'd committed the murders, and he was acquitted in late 1917. So there was a lot going on with him, but I think this question of mental illness,
sure,
plays a huge factor. Was he a pervert? Sounds like he probably was.
He does. But was he a killer?
That's the question. And I think the confession. Was the confession real? or was it given under duress? We did say he was interrogated, you know,
yeah,
intensely. So you can read into that what you want. You can also make the argument that his mental state was at a point where maybe he was willing to say whatever they wanted him to say. You can go all kinds of different routes with it.
It is strange that he did work himself into the case as much as he did before the arrest. I think that's strange.
Yeah. And we know that killers do that.
Yeah. But we also know other people do that too, out of curiosity. And then because of that association, maybe he was thought to be guilty.
That could be as well. All right, Gibbs, let's take our last break to talk about AirMed Care Network. You know, in every single episode that we do, we dive into a lot of unforeseen scenarios. So as everyone listening knows, the unexpected does happen. If a medical emergency arises, an AirMed Care Network membership protects your family and your finances. AirMed Care Network crews provide air medical transport to the nearest and most appropriate trauma center. And as a member, you'll never see a bill for that flight. That's right, members never pay a dime for transport when flown by an AMCN provider. Health insurance may not cover the full cost of emergency medical air transport. So this is a very important membership to have. It covers everyone in your household for just pennies a day. And right now, True Crime All the Time Unsolved listeners get up to a $50 Amazon or Visa e-gift card when you join. So be prepared with an AirMed Care Network membership. Visit airmedcarenetwork.com/true and use the offer code TRUE. Numerous theories and suspects were pursued at various stages of the investigation, in addition to Reverend Kelly. I think one of the things that police had to do was exclude anyone from either Josiah or Sarah's families. We know Josiah's brother-in-law, Sam Moyer, had made threats to kill Josiah, not just once. He made them a couple of times. Moyer's name had come up in the first round of court proceedings against Reverend Kelly. But according to the Evening Standard, Moyer had an alibi that satisfied police that there was no way he could have committed the crime. Moyer was found to have arrived in Nehaka, Nebraska, the morning after the murders, so police ruled him out as being in Villisca the night before. Another suspect, Andrew Sawyer, just like Reverend Kelly, was also passing through Villisca. Following the murders, he was seen behaving strangely, and he also had a great interest in the case. Police interviewed him, but decided there was insufficient evidence to charge him. All right, not a lot there. I get it. He's passing through. He had a great interest in the case, but the way I see it, Gibbs, I think a lot of people had a great interest in this case. We mentioned it. They stormed the house.
They did.
Practically.
Yeah.
Trying to get a look at the murder scene.
This was big news.
And really, no one was off limits when it came to a police inquiry. And this included politicians. Iowa State Senator Frank Jones was Josiah's former boss. Before Josiah started his own business in 1908, he'd worked for Senator Jones for almost 10 years. But when Josiah's business started to thrive, this caused some friction between the two men. Some of Jones' biggest customers took their business to Josiah instead.
Well, nobody likes to lose business to a competitor.
No, especially if that competitor was your friend, you know, somebody that used to work for you. I don't know if friend was the right word, but there might be some envy, some jealousy there.
But not enough to murder somebody.
I wouldn't think so. But rumors also swirled around town that Josiah was having an affair with the senator's daughter-in-law. So I think you could look at some motive there.
Well, we know that Josiah was definitely attacked more viciously than anybody else in that house that night.
So you could make the argument that he was the main target. There have been some over the years who have speculated that Senator Jones outsourced the killings to William Mansfield, who we've already mentioned. In later years, Mansfield was also the prime suspect for some axe murders committed in Paola, Kansas, 4 days before the Villisca murders and the murders of two women in Aurora, Illinois in 1914. This is all according to the Telegraph Herald newspaper. In all three of these cases, the same MO was used. As in Villisca, the mirrors in the homes of the Paola and Aurora victims had been covered over. Okay, that's pretty strange.
I think so too.
Because I thought it was strange just in the Villisca murder.
Right.
Now you have similar axe murders where the mirrors are also covered. And just how often would you see something like that?
I mean, I can see why you would think these would be linked together.
Yeah. No, I can too. According to the Sioux City Journal, the killer wore gloves to avoid leaving fingerprints, washed up in a basin in the kitchen, and left an oil lamp at the foot of the bed with the chimney off.
Very similar as the other ones.
Everything, right? No fingerprints, washed up in a basin, and then left the oil lamp without the chimney at the foot of the bed. Now, there was no real evidence to implicate Senator Jones, but just the suspicion around his possible involvement brought his political ambitions to an end.
Yeah, it probably didn't take much at that point.
No, once you kind of get that mud slinging going on, it's kind of hard to get that off you.
It is, even if you didn't do anything wrong.
The other tidbit that came out about Senator Frank Jones was that it was said that he played a key role in the arrest of Reverend Kelly after he campaigned for the release of Mansfield.
Now, why is that?
Well, I think people argue it's because he had something to do with it. Mm-hmm. Maybe in cahoots with Mansfield. I get Mansfield out and I throw the suspicion onto this Reverend Kelly.
And everybody leaves me alone.
Right. I have no idea if that's true, but that's the kind of things that you see floating around.
Yeah.
Theories, speculation. I mean, that, you know, really gives us all we have in a case like this. Now, we have a couple of suspects who today we would call serial killers. Obviously, in the early 1900s, nobody ever heard of a serial killer. That term wasn't used back then. A man named Henry Lee Moore came to the attention of law enforcement because he was a known killer. Now, Moore's a pretty common name, but he was not related in any way to the Moore family. Several months after the murders, Henry Lee was convicted for killing his mother and grandmother with an axe in mid-1912. According to the Sioux City Journal, he was also said to have killed over 20 people throughout the Midwest. So like I said, today we would call him a serial killer.
And just because he used an axe doesn't mean that he was guilty of the other murders.
No, we mentioned it. There were a number of different axe murders throughout the years. I think it's something that people look at, right, and try to tie together. But like you said, I don't think it necessarily means anything. Now, it does sound like he might have been a pretty prolific killer. So
it does sound like that.
Maybe somebody to look at. And then as recently as 2017, another suspect was named. The man's name is Paul Mueller, who, like Henry Lee Moore, was also believed to have been a very prolific killer. Mueller wasn't identified by police, but instead by two authors, Bill James and Rachel McCarthy James, in their book, The Man from the Train. The pair named Mueller as the killer responsible for almost 15 separate cases of axe murders across the country.
That's a lot.
That is a lot. This started with the 1897 murder of a Massachusetts family who had previously employed Mueller as a farmhand. As detailed in the James's book, the mystery attacker targeted victims across the country who lived near a railroad, sneaking into their homes under the cover of darkness while they were asleep. He used an axe that he found at the victim's home, and the killer used the blunt side to bludgeon them in the head. Then he covered the victims as well as their windows. So there's a similarity there, right? The covering of the windows. But again, I would think that's more of a common sense type thing.
Yeah, I think you would want the windows covered so people didn't see what was going on in the house, and also so the bodies wouldn't be discovered immediately.
Now, before slipping away, apparently he left a macabre calling card in the form of the bloodstained axe before locking the doors and disappearing into the night. In many of these cases where teen girls were among the victims, there were also indications there was a sexual aspect to the crime. Could it have been Paul Mueller? Sure. Could have been, I guess.
Yeah.
I have no idea. Could it have been any of these people? I mean, I think that's one of the things that draws people to this case, right? There have been a number of suspects over the years. This Paul Mueller guy was a pretty recent development, but we still don't really know who the killer was. And you and I talk about it all the time, right? The more years that pass, the less likely we'll ever know who did it.
Right.
Let alone why.
Sure.
In this case, especially when you're going back that far, number one, the killer's most likely dead.
Sure.
I would say 100% dead, but probably anyone that may have even known who the killer was is probably dead as well.
Yeah.
I mean, we're over 100 years on. So unless somebody left a detailed letter, journal, and it's locked away somewhere in an attic and, you know, somebody's never seen it.
Or that time machine I've been working on finally starts to work. I can go back.
Man.
Yeah.
You just gave me a good idea.
Yeah.
For a show.
Yeah.
We hit the time machine.
Okay.
Like Bill and Ted.
Yeah.
But instead of historical figures, we go back to famous unsolved crime scenes to figure out who did it.
Or you know what? We can get like a really cool sports car and go really fast and maybe like hit some like power pole lightning or something.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that will take us back in time.
I figure like 88 miles an hour probably should do it.
Would that be like the right speed?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. I think we're on to something.
You have to check that out. But no doubt, these were tragic murders.
Oh, you know, absolutely. And, you know, go back to 1912 to make national news coverage. It was a big deal. I said it. We'll probably never know who the culprit was, but online sleuths continued to debate the Villisca axe murders today. Yeah, I think the other thing that it kind of helps remind us is that, you know, violent crime isn't a a new thing. It's been around forever.
Yeah. I mean, you think about this case, you think about when we did the Dayton Strangler, 1900 time frame. Terrible.
Jack the Ripper back in the 1800s. And, you know, throughout history.
Sure.
There's always been someone who wanted to hurt someone else. Today, you can actually visit the house, which has changed hands many times, but was restored in the 1990s and is now on the U.S. National Register of Historic Places. It's been the subject of several documentaries and continues to be the site of many paranormal investigations. This is something that comes up in the research quite a bit. When you look into this case, a lot of people think that the house is haunted. There's some paranormal stuff going on.
Sure.
Now, I don't know that there's been any conclusive evidence as to whether the house is haunted, but a lot of people think it is.
I don't think I'd want to spend the night there.
No. I'm not spending the night there. I'm not spending the night at the Amityville house. Let's just get all of those out of the way.
Oh, I can't even get you to spend a night at my place.
I'd rather spend the night in Villisca than spend the night at your place. But like you said, I mean, it is a tragic story.
Right.
I think the fact that 100+ years on, people online continue to debate it, talk about it, you know, who's a good suspect? Nope, I don't think this person could have done it. I think it's this person.
Right.
It really kind of demonstrates the enduring lure to some of these older cases.
I agree.
But that's it for our coverage of the Villisca axe murders. We got some voicemails, Gibbs. You want to check those out?
Let's hear them.
Hi, first-time caller, Alex from California. I was just wondering if you could do a case that not a lot of people know about. There's not a lot of information. Maybe that's why no one's done it. But it's about Carla Anderson in Minnesota. I believe it was in the 80s, I believe. But she went missing, and she still to this day has never been found. OK, Okay, thanks, guys. Love your podcast.
Hey, we'll have to check that case out.
Yeah, definitely. Now, she said the key words. There may not be a lot out there.
Right.
That's what we often run into, but we got to check it out first and see.
We will.
Good afternoon, Mike and Gibby. It's Latasha from Richmond, Virginia. Just wanted to say how much I adore and I love your podcast, both of them, True Crime All the Time and also True Crime Unsolved. I've actually listened to all of your podcasts to the point where I re-listened to another podcast, and there was one that you did back in 2018 on the Briley brothers, and it shocked me because I didn't catch it, or maybe I wasn't really paying attention to it, but it literally happened here in Richmond, Virginia, and it's definitely not a funny matter, but I was so shocked because I always hear all the time, like, how people say, you know, that place was really close to where I live, but they drive past that place. And now I can officially say that as well. I think it was so crazy and terrible what those young men did. But other than that, I just wanted to thank you so much for continuously putting out a podcast that is not only informative, your banter is awesome, but it's just really such a pleasure to listen to. I love you guys so much. I put you guys on my cap and gown when I graduated from college. I put Keep Your Own Time Ticking, and a lot of people asked me about it, and I said, oh, this is my favorite podcast of all time. Is this the two? Listen to it. And I got a couple of people that like true crime as I do. So said all that to say that I just thank you so much for putting out podcasts week after week after week. I truly enjoy it. It's literally the highlight of my whole week, and I hope you guys are well and safe, and happy pre-holidays. Thank you. Bye.
Oh, so nice.
It is nice.
Appreciate the kind words. We always do, Gibbs. It makes us feel good. It's heartwarming.
Love it.
It's a good feeling.
It certainly is.
What's up, guys? Just wanted to say I'm a huge fan of the show. I really like listening to it. Gets me through my work day. I'm definitely team Mike and Gibby, but I got to say I have more in common with Fergie. You know, there's a lot that I can point out, but, I just wanted to mention that. But definitely appreciate the show. You guys are great. And I was wondering, I don't know if you guys have your own group, like, run by you guys specifically, because that fan group that's on Facebook, I don't know, I just left it because that admin seems to be, like, very very unfair and very opinionated. But, you know, I just didn't know if you guys had your own one that I could maybe go follow or join. But, yeah, thanks again, guys, you know, for everything you do, all the hard work you put in, you know, and, you know, I hope to get in touch with you at some other point. Thanks, bye.
All right, appreciate the voicemail. So the fan group is just that. It's a fan group for fans, started by fans, run by fans. Gibby and I really don't have anything to do with it. And I know every now and then something kind of breaks loose and people get upset about something said in the fan group. And sometimes they email us and say, I can't believe this is happening. But it's important to remember it is a fan group. It's not something that we control or try to regulate because it's just not ours. Now, we do have our own pages on Facebook, one for True Crime All the Time and one for Unsolved. And we interact some as much as we can, but it's not the same type of, you know, group setting. I'll say that. But we appreciate the voicemail very much. All right, buddy. That is it for another episode of True Crime All the Time Unsolved. So for Mike
and Gibby,
stay safe and keep your own time ticking.
Get ultimate protection and durability for your painting project at Menards. Get a paint that combines durability and gorgeous color. Dutch Boy's DuraClean Interior Paint and Primer in 1 offers Stay Clean technology, making your home stay beautiful and clean longer. And with Dutch Boy's easy opening smooth pouring container, transforming your home has never been easier. Save big money on Dutch Boy paints and head into Menards to get your paint project started today. Save